This is Bill Lindeke for the Streets.mn podcast, conversations about transportation, public space, and urban design in the Twin Cities. The podcast this week is a conversation with Ursula Lang, a PhD candidate in geography at the University of Minnesota, who is just completing her dissertation on the social life of yards. I know Ursula through my experience in the same geography department, and I sat down with her the other day at Cahoots Coffee Shop in St. Paul to talk about her research, where she interviewed and studied people who practiced their yards in three different neighborhoods in Minneapolis. Ursula explained to me about the history of yards as an idea and a physical space, how people view and experience yards differently, and why thinking about yards might reveal something important about the value of overlooked spaces and aspects of everyday life. I guarantee you won't look at your yard the same way after you hear this podcast, and I hope you enjoy the conversation.
I'll try to be intelligent. Sounding.
Well, welcome to the podcast. We're here with Ursula Lang. We're sitting in Cahoots Coffee Shop, which is in St. Paul, Minnesota, on Selby Avenue. It's a nice place that I've been going to for 10 years, and they have great coffee, especially the Turkish coffee.
Which is, now I know.
Yeah, it's like spiced. Anyway, Ursula, hi, how are you today?
I'm good. Hi, Bill. Yeah.
Well, you're a geographer like myself.
Yes.
Being a PhD in geography at U.
I am. Yeah. I am.
What's your PhD about?
I have been studying people's front and back and side yards. And I've been focused on three different neighborhoods in Minneapolis. I feel like I should be looking at the microphone.
No, it's fine.
Okay.
The red light's on.
And, so I've talked with people about their yards and spent time with them in their yards. Taken a lot of photographs of yards, and I've also looked at city policies to do with yards and sustainability, and thought about how cities understand green space, this kind of private green space, in relation to other sorts of environmental goals and green spaces in the city.
Yeah, wow. That's like all of the things. But let's just even talk about what a yard is. Like, so it's the space between the house and the public street.
Yeah.
And
the space between the house and another house.
Okay. And you and I, like, let's just say we both were just in Europe, where
yes,
Northern Europe. I don't know. They don't really have yards in the center cities or in the main cities in Helsinki or Copenhagen or whatever.
Right.
Like, it's not a thing.
Right.
You do get yards in like more suburban areas, and so it seems to me that yards are, and that's maybe true for a lot of places in the U.S. too. Like New York doesn't have yards, except when you get
right
to Queens,
right,
and then the yards start growing larger as you go.
Yeah.
Into the suburbs. So are yards a suburban concept? I guess is my question.
Yeah, I mean, interesting, because in the areas in Minneapolis that I've been studying, which are now sort of considered by the people who live in them to be pretty urban, people talked a lot about distinctions that they experience between urban yards and suburban yards. But they were all developed in the 1920s, 10s and 20s, as suburbs, as streetcar suburbs. So in that sense, in the U.S., I think yards have always been caught up with suburban development.
And this kind of image of, like, your own land, your own, like, terra firma.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely part of it. But I think one of the things that's interesting about, especially smaller yards in denser areas, but also bigger yards, are the ways that they're doing the other sorts of kind of social functions beyond just, like, my private property. So that's one of the things I've been interested in. Because a lot of the work on yards has sort of dismissed them as like this bourgeois sort of like, you know, this is just my little homestead, the home is my castle, and that kind of stuff.
And the yard is a symbolic sort of like spatial idea, landscape, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I don't know. That's probably still happening, though. It's like that we have different kinds of landscape or images that yards become.
Yeah, and there are, I mean, that's definitely part of it. And a lot of people talked about the sense of owning their land and sort of this sense of ownership and stewardship of yards with a kind of longer sense of time. So people talked about kind of what they grew and how they made decisions about their yard, and then how subsequent people who lived in their home would experience that. And kind of like, you know, I'm doing this gardening and yards, or in my yard, for, you know, the future people who live in this house to enjoy, kind of thing. But I think there are layers of, like, you know, this is my individual property, I have a right to do, you know, what I want, all those sorts of caricatures that I think we have, those are all there. But I think what's kind of more interesting and more complicated is then, like, how these spaces participate in social functions that are, like, more collaborative, more about commons and more about connections and, you know.
Yeah. Two images hopped to mind. One is the TV show Tim the Toolman Taylor. It's like a sitcom from the 90s.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like the handyman. He does
Home
the TV
Improvement.
Home Improvement.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then his backyard neighbor, he never shows his face.
Oh,
he's
always
standing
just
by the fence. He's got the hat. And howdy neighbor. And then like just the yard, that's like the backyard fence conversation is this cliche that's in like cartoons from like Better Homes and Gardens. And,
yeah.
You know, yeah. Like in Red Book back in like the 60s. And like this idea of the fence and the neighbor.
And privacy.
Yeah. But also like a congenial sort of relationship that goes over the fence. And also this sort of relationship between the you in this in society, it becomes this image for like keeping up with the Joneses, like I don't know. So that's one of the images that I have in my mind, and then the other one is like a Dame Jacobs sort of thing about like eyes on the street or porches, and she talks about porches as being important. Urban
stoops.
People.
Yeah.
Yeah, porches and stoops and these places where there's interactions with the street going on, you know, in a semi-public, semi-private way. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, well, the thing that comes to mind about the fences is one of the sort of classic geographic principles of, like, thinking about boundaries as not just separating, but points of connection. And, like, you know, there's been some work on the ways that fences sort of function in front yards in L.A. with James Rojas has written a little bit about front yards in L.A. as enacted environments, he calls it. And the front fence and the front gate becomes a way to sort of a place to hang out and then talk to people on the sidewalk.
Can you describe like what LA yard might look like that's different from maybe a Minnesota yard?
Well, in the areas he was looking at in East Los Angeles, lots of immigrant, multiple different generations, but from Mexico, I think, was his focus, but also other parts of Central America. And the front yard often has like a chain link fence. That's basically kind of at the property line. So then it becomes a way of interacting with neighbors that's sort of not as intimate as the front porch and then the front door. And, you know, there's kind of this gradation kind of idea that he uses. And then Margaret Crawford's done some work also on similar ways of using that sort of fence landscape to hang goods for sale and have, you know, informal garage sales or yard sales, that kind of stuff.
I was helping a friend of mine with a garage sale right before coming over here to this coffee shop.
Wow, so there you go.
Actually, yard sales are a fascinating thing, I think. It's one of the few moments where you see, like, people's stuff in public.
Yeah.
You know? It's like they're taking their stuff and they're literally airing it out for you to see.
Yeah.
And I find that fascinating.
Well, it's interesting because in the Bay Area where I lived in the East Bay before coming to Minneapolis, I think the density of people meant, like in Oakland and Berkeley, that you could put stuff out for free on the street and it would just disappear.
Yeah.
And so there was this whole, all these sort of like circuits of stuff that would disappear. It was really convenient because you could like get rid of stuff really easily and then you could find stuff really easily. You'd just be like going to get a coffee and
there's
a great table.
Yeah.
And, you know, now there's a drought so nothing gets wet. But the other interesting thing about fences is some of the other work I've done on the history of yards in shelter magazines in the first half of the 20th century.
Okay, wait. What?
I've done some work on the history of yards in shelter magazines.
What's a shelter magazine?
Home magazines.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Like Ladies Home Journal, that kind of stuff. And there was a lot of kind of uncertainty about what yards are in the early decades, like in the 1910s and 1920s. In America, people in the U.S., people hadn't really sort of like settled on what yards are, and so there was a lot of really interesting sort of discourse and debate in these magazines about what yards are for. And this is part of the sort of suburban development that's happening in the U.S. at that time. But
are they for playing here?
Even terms like play, like backyard, front yard, and stuff aren't even really settled at that point. They don't happen that much. And then there are these funny sort of diagrams of like what you can do in a yard, and then different competitions. They had like a model making competition where they were given a blank slate of like a rectilinear property with a house and a garage, because that was new with the car and the driveway. And then people had to like lay out sort of the ideal, you know, property and how it was organized. And so they had these photos of models that women had made and sent in to like be part of this competition. But
it kind of reminded of a landscape architecture class I took. And you're trained as an architect, right?
Also, I am, yes.
Landscape architect?
Architect, straight
just
up.
Just a regular, yeah. straight up. Yeah. But I took this landscape architecture class. And it was like a lot about these like palatial gardens and the kind of origins of those, you know, 1800s or palaces and English gardening and like,
yeah.
And so how that becomes kind of a like an imaginary that people then try to enact or create in their yards and their spaces, especially in high class neighborhoods. And then you get these distinction levels, right? So like everybody wants to create a space that is more one class up from where it might be.
Yeah, sort of aspiring, aspirational.
Yeah. Aspirational yards.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
So there's that thing.
Yes. But by the 40s really, especially during World War II, when there was all this kind of like nostalgia for security and home, and the magazines were used a lot by women to like make collages of what they wanted their homes to be like once their boyfriends and husbands came home from the war. There's a whole world of like scrapbooks that were made by women during World War II that this guy Andy Shankin at Berkeley in the architecture department has studied. But by the 50s there was all this emphasis on privacy and the fence, and there's a lot of really overt stuff about like the importance of fences as defining your property as an American citizen, and a lot of like layers of Cold War and communism and like worries about collective property and how the fence becomes this like real necessity in the yard to like delineate exactly where your property is. Oh. It's really interesting.
It's not the fence lobby like totally taking over?
It could be. There's probably, I'm sure, like trade, you know, industries were involved.
But no, I get it.
Chain link, you know, manufacturers. But but it was really a big like really strong narratives about that happen, about all around fences.
Yes. So that's kind of a urban bifurcation that happens around World War II when you go from like playing in the street to playing in the yard.
Yeah. And there's a shift in terms of utilities too. So some of the explanations about yards that have been in the literature have talked about the ways that indoor plumbing and technological innovations in the kitchen and laundry affected then, you know, there was kind of this blank slate then of this space that wasn't, especially in the backyard, that was no longer used for like coal ash and
clotheslines,
well, and like latrines and the whole gamut of, you know, household sort of utilities that were happening outside much more. So by the 20s and 30s, a lot of those things were sort of starting to phase out. So there was this space in the back that was sort of newly reborn. And,
Well,
so it's tied up with like, you know, domestic technologies too.
This is a lot of history. It's great. It's really interesting.
So
I bet most people don't think about yards, and you just laid some knowledge on them.
I think so. People make funny expressions when they ask me what I'm studying, and I say front backyards. Some people get it right away, and other people are like, Some people talk only about lawns. So that's one part of my project that I've been trying to expand people's imagination beyond just lawn or no lawn.
So tell me about your methodology for your research project. I'm kind of curious, like, what you actually did. Like,
yeah.
You know, did you like, the image I have is you with a magnifying glass crawling around in the grass, like just looking at the yard really closely. Like, literally.
Yeah. If you add in the homeowner, it was mostly homeowners. Unfortunately, I had a hard time finding renters, but if you add them into the mix, that's kind of what I did. So I drove around and biked around and tried to find three different kind of yard cultures that I could sort of tell from just the outside as being kind of an outsider. And I was interested in setting up the study so that I could understand how people's yards along kind of at the scale of a city block or several blocks, how the yards interacted kind of with one another. I mean, how the neighbors interacted through their yards, however you want to say it. So that meant I wanted to get as many kind of in-depth interviews and yard visits with people on the same block as I could. So I kind of decided, okay, I've got this, you know, 5 or 10 block radius in these three different parts of the city, and basically I just did flyers on front doors and hung around. I went to community meetings, tried to meet people.
Was that easy? Do people want to talk about their yards?
People want to talk about their yards, but I think one of the challenges of studying sort of everyday life, broadly defined, is that it's hard to, like, people don't really understand what you're doing. Like, they don't really understand what you're interested in, like, or that the thing is interesting to them, because it's just kind of mundane. So there were, like, avid gardeners who were excited to talk about their yard and their gardening specifically, but then I also wanted to find people that, like, weren't necessarily, didn't see themselves as gardeners or weren't seen by others as gardeners. You know, I wanted to get a whole range of sort of, like, yards.
Yeah, that's much more interesting. But that's harder.
Yeah. So, I mean, I just kind of hung around, and some people were really receptive, mostly older people. I mean, a lot of people I talked to were, like, 60, 65. You know, they had more time. It was hard to set up meetings, too, because people would sort of, you know, like, oh, just come by anytime. But, like, you know, I knew it was going to be an hour or two meeting with them. I'd ask them questions. We'd walk around the yard. I'd say, show me your yard, and they would tell me, and I'd kind of follow their lead because I wanted to know what they considered important about the yard and the order of things they wanted to tell me about and stuff. So, but yeah, basically, once I had people that were interested, I just tried to go, and we had these kind of in-depth yard visits. So we'd sit, do interview questions, and then walk around and have kind of a mobile interview. And then as much as I could, I went back for follow-up visits. So I would go back, and just sometimes it was just really casual, like I'd be in the neighborhood and see them and chat, or I did ask people to take photographs of their yards and keep a yard diary of their yard activities.
That's what I was going to ask about, is like, that's yeah. Be interesting to know, like, hey, I mean, will they actually do it is
yeah.
the question, but
well, about a third of them did.
I hung out or I played, you know, like, yeah. I think of my parents lived about less than a mile from here, and I hang out and play in their yard with my little nephew.
Yeah.
We play this game called Cowboy, where you have to throw the ball at him, and then if you catch it, then it's your turn to throw the ball at the other one, and then you run for some reason.
Yeah,
that he makes made sense. It up. Yeah. But it's a fun game.
Yeah.
But that's in the yard. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, other than that, the yard gets used in really interesting ways. But
yeah,
it would be interesting to like track that, you know, like time geography, like you know. 40 minutes sitting in the chair.
Yeah, well, so I tried to, like, you know, it was all sort of self-reported. But I had a sort of a set of questions, and then I just copied it. I had, like, 14 pages of this same, you know, did you spend time in your yard today? What did you do? Did you see people?
You know, you needed some unmanned drones.
Well, I did do a little experiment with a time-lapse game camera.
Okay. Like cougar?
One yard, yeah.
Like a cougar late at night.
Yeah, so. I set it up in one of his trees. This guy was game to try it. And so that was kind of cool, but it was during a heat wave, so there wasn't a lot of yard activity.
Okay, that's really funny. That's the future, man.
Yeah.
They're going to cut, we don't even need geographers in the future.
No, just unmanned drones for everything. But yeah, so for this project, it was mostly kind of unstructured interviews, lots of time together in the yards. And then
you said there were three yard cultures.
Yeah, I mean, I went to three different neighborhoods, and I was looking for sort of different types of neighborhoods. So one was kind of historically white, working class in Northeast Minneapolis, small homes, and the second was in North Minneapolis, which was an interesting area that had been people in the 20s and 30s were largely Jewish families lived in this neighborhood, and then they moved further west to the suburbs, and African American families moved in, and so that, you know, is kind of a familiar trajectory in American cities. But big homes and kind of pretty big yards, and then a kind of more affluent area in South Minneapolis near the lakes, kind of more kids in that neighborhood, I would say. The other two neighborhoods were a little bit older.
That's interesting. Usually you don't think that would be the case. I think about Powderhorn, which is a place, or my neighborhood in the west side of St. Paul.
Yeah.
A lot of Latinos and a lot of kids everywhere playing in the yards. My backyard, it's apartment buildings, and then there's this kind of liminal space in the middle, marginal space, I guess. It's just this concrete area that all the kids in the apartment building next door use as sort of a constantly shifting array of activities, like skateboarding, pile of mattresses, basketball hoop, log that has become a bench.
Yeah.
It's like always evolving and used as kind of escape for the kids in the apartment building.
That's cool.
I don't know.
Yeah.
That's how I picture a lot of sort of working class neighborhoods looking.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I look at both photos from the 20s all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
No, but yeah, okay, so I'm kind of curious, one of the questions that I thought of before we were talking was like, how does a culture sort of emerge? You know, it's like, so there's certain neighborhoods in different cities that are famous for having like really nice gardens, like throughout the whole neighborhood.
Yeah.
Like Bryn Mawr, Prospect Park, jump to mind, but
how
does that happen? Like, what does it mean when that happens? You know, is it important? Like, does it create community identity? Probably.
Yeah, I went on, you know, a lot of neighborhoods have garden tours in the summers, usually the first or second week in July, and I went on a lot of those. And Bryn Mawr was one that was, you know, just across kind of the tracks, just across the highway from my other neighborhood, and so in North Minneapolis. So it's an interesting, a lot of people talked about the Bryn Mawr Gardens as kind of a, I don't know, point of comparison. But yeah, I think there are distinct places part of the thing I found in the blocks that I was studying more closely is that, you know, there's often like one or two people on a block who become sort of the resident experts, and then there's this whole exchange of plants and expertise and advice, and a lot of that's just super informal. Like, you know, I've got these extra hostas I'm dividing this week. Do you want them? Or, you know, they might look good at that spot. Or so for some of the older gardeners, they felt like they were sort of provisioning, you know, younger, newer homeowners with, you know, stuff for their yards. And there was this sense of, like, getting them established. And so a lot of people talked about that, which I think is one way that there might be like a local sort of aesthetic or a local culture would sort of emerge through these networks.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about, I think Prospect Park has known for like getting a lot of native plants in their gardens.
Yeah.
It's sort of a disheveled, but also really hard to pull off kind of thing.
Yeah. So that was interesting because in my South Minneapolis neighborhood, a lot of people were kind of aspiring towards that aesthetic. In North Minneapolis, it was much more ornamentally focused. So there were, like, you know, more linear, simpler. I don't even know if simpler is the right word, but there was still a lot of effort, but it was more formal and more about ornament rather than, like, native species or food.
That totally makes sense.
Yeah.
Oh, you said food. That's an interesting topic.
Yeah.
But,
so.
Yeah. I'm thinking of a yard near my house that is just like kind of adorable but so cheesy. It's just got this like maybe 1 foot high white fence and these little red flowers that are planted like in these
like symmetrically.
Yeah. And it's just very deliberate and very simple and cute, you know, but it's totally not the native plant aesthetic at all.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a lot there because I mean, not across the board, but many of the sort of native plant advocates and also the urban food advocates I think sometimes dismiss that kind of gardening and that kind of yard, you know, as like not desirable. But there's still a lot of like the people who cultivate their yards that way, they're still putting in a lot of effort and a lot of time and attention. And so I think, I don't know, I think we as kind of like a, you know, green, environmentally focused sort of advocacy community need to be really careful about understanding what people are doing in their yards to begin with before we like march in and say, you know, this is the prescription for like what the new yard should be, because it doesn't necessarily compute. And so, you know, I don't know, that's one sort of part of the project that is interesting, especially especially in the context of different like race relationships in the city, you know, economic class and all that
stuff. Yeah, so the yard cultures are tied into all these other points of differentiation.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about conflict, like yard conflict. And an example, someone years ago had given me an article about, again, I think Latino yards in somewhere in Southwest, about how people like will fix their cars in their yards, or that's kind of the classic image of parking your car and fixing it all, and versus having a yard as a sort of green space, and that's a point of contention that a lot of places.
Yeah.
Like, what are the city rules about what you can and can't have? How tall your grass can be? Can you park your car on cement blocks out there?
No, there's lots. The parking car is the main kind of like point of some of the housing maintenance codes. Like, you cannot park your car on the grass. So there's all this sort of
can you pave the grass?
Yeah, but it's just a 6 o'clock.
I should know this off the top of my head, but I don't. The conflict side of yards is interesting. It was hard to get people to talk about it because everyone kind of just wanted to like show me around their nice yards, you know. So a lot of it comes through in the city planning stuff, and you know, a lot of the codes in the city, there are two ways that they like enforce the housing and maintenance codes. One is they do this sweep through every property in the city every summer, and they have like summer interns go around and do this. So that's why there's a lot of sometimes confusion and conflict about prairie, you know, native prairie landscapes versus weeds and overgrown abandoned landscapes. And like, so a group goes around, I haven't done this with them, but they go around from yard to yard and like mark citations and stuff. But the other way that a lot of these codes get enforced is mostly primarily through like neighbor complaints. So it's kind of complaint driven. So if you are, you know, I think that's why there can be these different sort of cultures in the yards across the city, because, you know, it's sort of what are the sort of local collective norms about what yards are. And in the backyard, it's according, you know, from the city's perspective, in the backyard, almost anything goes as long as the neighbors aren't complaining. In the front and the side yards, there's stricter sort of restrictions about what kind of structures you can have, what kind of materials you can use. So.
What's the worst story you've heard about, like, yard fight?
Well, the people I talked with had, some people had like, numerous citations for various things. And they had a lot of ideas about sort of differential enforcement of these codes and how in some more working class neighborhoods, how people who were people that whose property from the outside looks like they could afford to pay the fines would be fined and other people wouldn't be fined. So and that was in several neighborhoods. Like, there were strong feelings about these citations and like strong opinions about seeing the sort of unevenness of the citations.
Yeah, and one of the problems is like bank-owned properties or whatever,
yeah.
and their yard maintenance. And this kind of leads to similar problems with snow shoveling in the winter, I'd bet.
Yeah.
In fact, I want to ask you about the winter. So our yard's a summer thing, and then in the winter it's like whatever, it's just snow?
Kind of. I wanted to do like a four-season kind of longitudinal thing, but I didn't really have a chance to visit with people in the winter. It was too hard to coordinate. But I did ask people about it, and you know, a lot of people talked about not seeing their neighbors at all, and then in the spring when it warmed up and people were sort of out doing yard tasks, then that was the sort of chance to catch up. And in one of the neighborhoods that had a really kind of lively, informal social gathering, so they have from Labor Day, from what's in May?
Memorial Day
to Labor Day.
My birthday is in May.
They have this thing called TGIF, thank God it's Friday, and they have these yard parties in people's backyards, and they have a sign that says TGIF, and they put it out in the front yard, and then it's just like this informal neighborhood thing, but they have all these rules, like people can only be outside, so you don't have to clean up your house. The food can only come out of a bag, so it's cheap. It's not anything you have to like labor over. The drinks have to be really cheap. They've got this kind of restriction. In order to make it like fun and loose and easy to do. So they did that for several years and they all had so much fun doing it, and then they realized that they never saw each other in the winter. And so some of them started hosting social events in October and November, and then in January and February they would like get together for coffee and donuts inside the house on Saturday mornings or something. So I think that's an indication that people really don't interact that much outside during the winter months.
Yeah. Snowman is
not surprising.
It.
Yeah.
Snow people, I should say.
Snow people. Yeah. So people talked about shoveling and different, like, you know, kind of their norms for those sorts of things. So like yard work in the winter. But
so what do you conclude in your dissertation?
What do I conclude? Yards are important, and they're more than just lawns. And they're more than gardening. And
do you hate the lawn thing?
I hate the lawn thing.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah,
like the mower.
Yeah, I asked about mowers. Push mower, gas mower. Nobody had a riding lawn mower in my project. But
oh, really? It's so un-American.
The yards are pretty small. Yeah, lawns. A lot of people had a lot to say about lawns, but I think that some of the like studies of yard spaces have focused so much on lawns that like we just lose sight of all the other things going on in yards. So that's probably one of my conclusions. I feel like I should revise my answer, and in a month I'll let you know more.
Yeah, no, that's very fine with me. What's your yard like?
My yard is kind of overgrown, and my interest in my own yard plummeted as I started this project. It's the same as like architects who never get around to, you know, renovating their own houses and stuff. It's just, I was done with the yard. I heard a lot about people's yards and plants, and I just didn't have time or energy. But I also had a small child in the course of doing this research project, and a lot of the people I talked with, I gleaned quite a bit of wisdom from the older participants, one of whom told me I had started working on my yard too soon. And so there's this whole kind of life history trajectory of people getting interested in their yards as their kids get to high school and college and move on and are not using the yard for any kind of games and stuff as much.
Maybe there's hope for your yard in the future.
There might be. I might be hiring some like professional help, but yeah.
Cool. I don't know. That's all I have, Ursula.
Okay.
Your topic sounds great.
I feel like I need a better conclusion.
Well, what would it be though?
I don't know.
Yards are.
I hope you're gonna edit.
Yards
those.
Are interesting. I'm not gonna edit unless you curse.
Yeah, yards are interesting and important.
Good.
Yeah.
And hopefully people will look at them and think more about the social life of them.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really what we're talking about, I think.
Yeah. I think it's important to think beyond the kind of caricature of the moat of lawn and the, like, limited view of private property as just this one singular thing based on, like, capitalist logics.
Yeah. There you go. That's good.
Property is practice. Yeah.
Good luck. You and I are going to finish our dissertations like in this month.
Yes.
That'll be good. Thanks for stuff. I'm going to hit stop. Good job.
Please.
Thanks for listening to the Streets.mn podcast. Again, please consider joining Streets.mn if you appreciate this podcast or any of the Streets.mn content. If you have any feedback or ideas, you can comment on Streets.mn, on Twitter at StreetsMN, or email me personally at blindeke@gmail.com. So long from the Selby Avenue in St. Paul. Thank you.